Okay, any other preliminary questions now that we all have books and I'm set for that. Okay. Well, we left off on Wednesday with a Hammond tree and kind of this general overview of the law of the law of negligence, the law of strict liability. Now we go more explicitly on defining what we mean by this term negligence. And we start out with this quaint little case of Lucan and the wasp who flies into the defendant's car. And we have to figure out whether the conduct of the defendant in that case was negligent or, contrarywise, met the standard of a reasonably prudent person. Mr. Reichert, can you tell me about Lucan? What's that? Can you tell me about the Lucan case, the wasp case here that we start with? Okay. And what's the procedural history of the case? What happens to the plaintiff when he tries to pursue the claim for compensation? Okay. What's the basis of the appeal? And what's your understanding of this instructed verdict? What is, there's another term more commonly used for what I'm guessing they're talking. What did the defendant want? Put it in other terms. Procedurally, what did the defendant want the judge to do? Excuse me, what the plaintiff wanted, yes. What the appellant, the plaintiff wanted the judge to do? Yeah, Ms. Manali. Is that the way you say it? Manali. Okay, what we're guessing here is that when the court uses this term instructed verdict, that's the same thing as what we've more commonly seen, actually, if you read in the appendix, procedural history of a simple case, this is what we've seen referred to as a directed verdict. And the concept here is that, or it can work the other way around. It can be a directed verdict for the plaintiff. It can be a directed verdict for the defendant. But the concept is that the judge, instead of saying to the jury, "What do you think about this?" the judge grabs the jury by the scruff of the neck and says, "Are you listening? This is what you're going to do," okay? So the judge directs a verdict rather than letting the jury make up their own mind. Now, there are times, it turns out, we saw some discussion of this back in the turntable case, when that's what the judge should do. And when is it that the judge is supposed to direct a verdict as distinguished from leaving it up to the jury to make the decision? Mr. Reichert, what's your understanding of the rule we follow as to when a judge is supposed to direct the verdict? Okay, that's one situation when we're trying to determine, for example, the meaning of a statute. We don't ask the jury, "Well, what do you think this statute means?" The interpretation of the law is for the judge. But even when it's a question of fact, and we've decided that the question about whether particular actions were reasonable or particular actions were negligent, we remembering back to the turntable case, we decided that determination is itself a question of fact for the jury, sometimes we don't let the jury get that question, even if it's a question of fact. The judge properly directs a verdict for the plaintiff or the defendant when drawing a blank there? Yeah, go ahead. Even if the facts are undisputed, remember back in the turntable case, the facts were undisputed and yet we let that case go to the jury? But the court recognized their Ms. Olmstead? When reasonable minds could only reach one conclusion. There is an answer to this question, says the judge, and let me give you what that answer is. Where a case presents itself, and remember the image that's presented back in the turntable case, a carriage that goes off the cliff. Well, I could imagine a set of circumstances where the defendant did such foolish things that a reasonable juror could only reach the conclusion that that was negligent. You could also imagine a set of circumstances in which the accident happened in a way where no reasonable person could reach the conclusion that there was any negligence. It was an accident, pure and simple. Of course, as they recognize, many cases don't lie at the extreme of being clearly one thing or clearly another. The case typically lies in the middle, but where it doesn't lie in the middle, but instead falls under that category of a case where reasonable minds could reach but one conclusion, then it is for the judge to take that case, direct a verdict, and we would know the outcome. The plaintiff says this is such a case, right? The plaintiff says where you're driving along and a wasp flies in the window, the stupidest thing you can do is take it upon yourself to become the Orkin guy, the exterminator here. Your job is to drive, shut up and drive, you know. If you're going to become the exterminator, pull over, you know. Bring the car to a stop, then go after the wasp. Trying to drive and hit the wasp at the same time is a really dumb idea. So dumb, says the plaintiff, that the judge should have decided this question as a matter of law. What does the appellate court say? What? Okay, but what the appellate court says is not so much rendering their own opinion about how to handle wasps that fly in your car. What the appellate court says is the question before us is what? What is it we have to decide? Not whether it's smart to swatter a wasp, but or whether this was a question for the jury or for the judge. Remember, the plaintiff's argument is this was a question for the judge. And the appellate court says we disagree. This is a case eminently well-suited to 12 jurors. Again, we get another stanza of this, another verse of our hymn of praise to the jury. You know, jurors are wonderful. They have we get all these people from the community. They have this life experience, different perspectives. 12 people who drive, who are passengers in cars, who've dealt with wasps before, we put it to them. What do you think? Did this guy act reasonably? Did he act unreasonably? What would this court have done if the jury had returned the opposite verdict? If they had found his conduct negligent, what would this court have said? Ms. Wisely? Yeah, fine. They're not trying to control the outcome here. They're trying to control the process. And the process is, we like what juries do. We, again, not only do juries provide this multiplicity of perspectives, balancing out the limitations we all have in our life experience, but we also get this kind of refreshment or reach, like a water table getting recharged by rainfall. When jurors sit on juries, and then they go back into the community and describe their experience, it reconnects the legal system with the people the legal system governs. So as I said before, we're not being governed by some external authority that lords it over us. It's you and I who decide what happens to the other people in our community, and they decide what happens to us. And isn't that great? In effect, says the court. Now, there, you don't have to join in the hymn of praise here. You can sit this one out to the extent that you have reservations about, you know, how jurors go about deciding things and the way things are and the cumbersomeness and the theatrical quality to jury trials. But at least this is a strong aspect of the system that we have. Now, I begin with this rather simple case in part to kind of remind us, before we get into all the technicalities of the elements of a res ipsa claim or the different jurisdictional variants on negligence per se and, you know, the rule for post-accident repairs, as you become, you know, sort of, if not obsessed, at least occupied with the legal technicalities, remember that in many cases the critical issue will not so much be how you resolve some interesting legal controversy, but what 12 people on a jury are going to think about a particular factual situation. And the other thing that's important is for you to get some sense of how you relate to this process. Remember that the assignment on the exam is you are given a fact pattern, and the question that comes at the end of the fact pattern is, you represent the plaintiff or you represent the defendant. Now, how would you assess their prospects, your client's prospects? Should your client be bracing for some impending disaster, or should your client be feeling pretty good that, well, you know, the thing's not quite in the bag yet, but all indicators look pretty positive here. Now, as you read about this guy swatting the wasp, you, like the appellate court, may very well have had your own opinion about whether he did a smart thing or he did a dumb thing. And that's a useful datum, you know, a little piece of information. What you think is stupid or what you think is smart, it's very likely that somebody on the jury is going to agree with you. But it won't necessarily be true that they'll all think like you. And you may, as you talk with your classmates and as you sort of read about these things, you may identify yourself somewhere on this spectrum of opinion where, gee, my initial instinct is to kind of see things through the eyes of the plaintiff. You know, my life experience and my philosophy about life leads me to look at the world in sort of plaintiff-friendly view. So when I read a fact pattern, I'm inclined to see why the defendant should compensate the plaintiff. Or it may be just the opposite. Your life experience and your philosophical orientation is such that when you read about these cases, you're kind of identify with the defendant. You're seeing all the reasons why the defendant shouldn't have to compensate the plaintiff. But again, the point of doing this is so that you can do a better job when your client looks to you and says, tell me what you think. Am I likely to come out of this thing okay? Am I going to collect some money, or am I going to avoid having to pay some money, or am I going to get out of this without being held liable, or am I going to be forced to pay a lot of dough? as your client asks you for your assessment, you not only take into account the legal issues that are involved. Well, gee, two out of three of the elements of this particular cause of action look pretty good. I think I could persuade a judge that you fit within this exception to that particular legal rule. But what is a jury going to think about your client's behavior or the behavior of the defendant from whom you're trying to recover? So, again, as I think I said before, knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know, knowing a little bit about yourself to say, you know, as I look at this, I think the plaintiff's got a great case, or I think the plaintiff's got a lousy case, but then again, I remember that I'm really kind of a plaintiff's guy, or I'm really kind of a defendant's guy, so before I assure my client, gee, this looks great, is this what I, am I seeing what I want to see, or contrary-wise, am I not seeing something that another person would see? For example, I represent the plaintiff, and I happen to be kind of a defendant's guy, and I see this, and it's, I would think, gee, I wouldn't give this plaintiff a nickel. But when I put on my cap as a lawyer, and my client looks to me and says, could I get some money out of this, it's not a question of, would I give the plaintiff some money, but would a jury be likely to give the plaintiff some money? So, again, the deference of the appellate court to say we like the jury system, we like giving juries the authority to make these sorts of decisions is an important thing to remember about the way the system works, that the standard of reasonable care often comes down to what are the jurors going to say. And simply knowing that fact helps me to advise my client, this is what your case will come down to. Now, later on, we'll talk about all these different, you know, methods of proving negligence and exceptions to legal cause and all sorts of areas where we get into you'll earn your keep doing the legal technicalities, but also bear in mind the importance of this principle of the role of the jury as well. Mr. Johnson? Well, but it's a little bit of both, because in order to answer the procedural question, we have to at least ask the substantive question. It's kind of a mixed bag, because what you're saying is, could a jury on this evidence reach the conclusion that the defendant acted reasonably? Again, it's not so much a question, do I think the defendant acted reasonably? Do I think it was a smart idea to try to drive and swat the wasp at the same time? But the question is, could a reasonable jury reach that conclusion? I think it's pretty easy to say they could reach the opposite conclusion, but the question the plaintiff raises in this case is, the plaintiff is trying to persuade us a reasonable jury couldn't reach the conclusion that he acted reasonably, and the appellate court said, no, we think a jury could. So again, it's this kind of self-reflective thing of saying, I know what I think, or maybe I know what I think about this, but let me think about this for a second. Is this something where reasonable minds, I could imagine a reasonable person taking the opposite point of view? And again, this is sort of that self-reflective, gee, is this an issue about which there's kind of a reasonable difference of opinion? Or is this just a no-brainer? Nobody's going to take the opposite side of this issue. All the reasonable people are going to be over here, and nobody's going to be on the other side that I would dignify with the term reasonable. And obviously, we have different standards of what that is, so that there are lots of issues we could probably go through in which you would say, oh, no reasonable person would take that position. And there would probably be other people in the room who would be on the opposite side saying the exact same thing of the people that took the other position. And then at some point, you have to figure out, okay, I don't agree with these people. I think they're wrong. But if I'm going to try to portray to you the state of the debate, I'd have to tell you in all honesty, hey, The jury's still out, as the expression goes, on this particular point. So again, being able to identify that's a very important skill that, that you want to be able to develop. Is it Connor Dudley? Well, it's actually one of the things that we'll get to in more detail in Martin versus Herzog. I forget where we are relative, how far out that is at this point, and how far you got in your Labor Day preemptive strikes. But in Martin versus Herzog, you get a question about whether or not, that's the buggy case where the guy in the buggy gets hit and he's accused of not having his light on. Even if you direct the verdict on one issue in the case, as a matter of law, this guy was negligent, there are often other issues in the case, such as proximate cause. Okay, that was negligent, but did it cause the injury? Even if we knew it caused the injury, in the case of a defendant, we would still have to say, yeah, but how much injury did that cause? What's the scope of the plaintiff's damages? So directing a verdict on one issue in the case doesn't necessarily eliminate the need for a jury. It means that the jury's job is now cut down from, well, we got to do this, this, and this. Well, we've taken care of step A. Now you can move on to B and C and D, E, and F, or whatever else is left. Mr. Cafferty. Well, what the judge would say, and remember, when the judge instructs the jury, the judge presents a lot of stuff on a platter and simply tells the jury, it's this way. This is the legal standard. This is the definition of negligence. This is the burden of proof. There's actually a whole bunch of stuff that's already prepackaged for the jury. So when the judge goes ahead and takes one little piece out of this, it says, oh, by the way, for purposes of your deliberations, you shall assume, or you shall, you know, I don't know how you'd put it, it is a fact for purposes of this case that the defendant was negligent. You know, the plaintiff's burden of proof now is to prove that that negligence proximately caused the damage and to prove the amount of damages and so forth and so on. So it actually doesn't seem totally unnatural. It would seem quite, the jury wouldn't realize, oh man, he's directing a verdict on this point, because the jury's already getting this raft of things that they're told in effect to simply accept as a given. So the mechanics of it. Now the judge's process of deciding which of these things do I give to them and which of them do I not, I think I mentioned in the appendix, it's not uncommon for judges to err on the side of giving more to the jury in the hopes that the jury, if in fact it's as clear as the judge thinks it is, the jury will come to the same conclusion. And that way nobody can complain, oh, you never let the jury decide it. So in this case, for example, the judge may have thought, after listening to the evidence, I think what this guy did was perfectly reasonable. And the judge might have been inclined to direct the verdict the other way, but decided, you know, just on this, in the interest of caution, I'm going to let the jury decide this one, and if necessary, I'll fix it later on. If the jury comes back and says this guy was negligent, how they would get there, I have no idea. If they were to do that, I would grant, this is the other procedural mechanism, judgment is a matter of law, or judgment notwithstanding the verdict, a judgment JNOV, judgment non obstante verdicta, the old Latin phrase. So a judgment notwithstanding the verdict is a way of saying, I know the jury said this, but they, I don't know what they were smoking at the time. Couldn't have been. No evidence for that. So I'm going to replace that verdict with the right judgment, because I know what happened, and this is the way it's got to be. Then that can be appealed, and we'll see many cases in which the judge has either granted it or refused to grant it, and it's an appeal from that decision to the appellate court, but at least we've had the jury's verdict, so if we turn the switch on or off, we're done with the case. The problem with the directed verdict, if as a judge I'm too quick to pull the trigger and say, I know the answer to this one, you know, wait, don't tell me, if I pull this thing too soon, and it turns out the appellate court said, wait a minute, there was evidence, you were too quick, you should have let the jury decide it, and we've got to go back and do this whole thing over again. So judges will be more inclined to let it go to the jury and fix it later, because in many cases they won't even have to fix it, as distinguished from, but judges, depending on their level of confidence, will say they'll grant summary judgment or they'll direct a verdict because they think that's an easier way to expedite things. Okay, Vaughn versus Menlove then. Another question about how do we know what constitutes reasonable care? Ms. Nelson, can you tell us about Vaughn versus Menlove? What's that? I didn't hear what you said before that. Yes. Okay. A chimney is basically like a passage of air going through so the haystack isn't, anyway, there's sort of some sort of ventilation. Yeah. So the plaintiff wants the defendant to compensate him for the fire damage. Okay, what happens when the case goes to trial? Actually, not quite. This rule nisi is, it's hard to even find anymore. I mean, it's the only place you'll ever see it is in this case, and it's sort of one of these little anomaly puzzles out there. It's a sort of a stay of execution. The rule nisi is essentially a hold on the enforcement of the judgment pending review of the case by the larger panel of judges. So same in the sense that we now have to review this case in light of the challenge to the instruction. So what is the defendant complaining about in the instruction? What did the instruction do wrong that the plaintiff that the defendant wanted fixed? Right. And what does that mean? Well, but he wants the standard to be whether he acted bona fides. What does that mean? Have you ever seen Brother, Where Art Thou? The sort of remake of Bill Merrick's story. I remember whatever the Holly Hunter character is running around saying bona fide. You know, I forget where that comes out. But in any event, that's the okay. The Latin term is in good faith. In good faith. So the idea is this person acting? The defendant says, don't judge me by some abstract, unembodied standard. I want you to, in effect, judge me by whether I did the best I could under the circumstances, given my limitations. Was I trying hard, in effect? Did I have the right motivation? Was I trying to do the right thing? Whether I was successful or not by somebody else's standard, that's not a fair comparison. I ought to be judged by what the cards I was dealt. Just while we're on that, you know, point, if the defendant had been successful in persuading the trial judge to instruct the jury in that way, and the standard had been whether he was pedaling as fast as he could. And there's some sort of hint in the case, it's not spelled out, but there's some hint that he had some kind of disability, that he He wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, as they say. But assuming he had gotten the judge to give the jury the standard, how do you think the jury would have resolved the case? If you had been sitting on the jury and the standard had been, did he act in good faith to the best of his ability? Why? Yeah, people are assuming he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, and everybody else seems to know about haystacks, and he still doesn't quite have the concept here. When they try to tell him, hey, this is the way you do it, he basically said, buzz off. I'll do it my way. So it doesn't even seem like this changing the standard would do him much good, at least not in this case. But you could imagine it would do other people. It would change the outcome in other cases. If, in fact, we used a standard that looked to the cards the plaintiff or the defendant was dealt in terms of abilities or, you know, perceptive capacity, instead of which the judge used a standard that says, regardless of this particular defendant's abilities or experience, we want you to compare his conduct to that of a reasonably prudent person. And if it matches up, as the guy in the Wasp case apparently matched up as far as the jury was concerned, or if the defendant didn't match up, as apparently the defendant didn't in this case, that's the test we're going to use, this objective standard rather than a subjective one. Why would you prefer, as a matter of, still, I know what the defendant would prefer. The defendant just wants a new trial, wants out from under this judgment, so the defendant's looking for a different standard. The plaintiff's going to be delighted with the standard because that's how he got his judgment. But we, not having a stake in the outcome of this particular case, we might have a perspective on whether it would be better or worse for us as a society if we made the standard like the one the defendant is proposing, or if we kept the one that the judge used. What can we say about the advantages or disadvantages of the defendant's proposed standard, this subjective standard? Why not? Well, but does the law ever look at a person's good faith or subjective state and base your reward or punishment on an evaluation of your subjective state of mind? Does the law ever do that? Where? Not just in the sentencing process, but if I'm on trial for murder, you can't convict me of murder if I'm just a klutz. You might convict me of negligent homicide, but before you convict me of the more serious forms of homicide, you've got to show that subjectively I knew what I was doing was risky. Or, if you want to get me for murder, you've got to show that I intended or desired a particular consequence. It's not murder if I lack that state of mind. In civil law, does it ever matter whether you're acting in good faith or not? It turns out, for example, in the standard for defamation, for libel and slander, the difference between being held liable for false statements about a public official may depend upon whether I entertain serious doubts about the truth of what I was publishing. If I didn't have any reason or didn't subjectively suspect that the information I'm peddling is false information, I don't have actual malice. And that's the test that we use to impose civil liability. So sometimes, in some areas of the law, we care about those things, and we will ask a jury, peer into the heart of this person and tell us, was this an accident? I mean, when you were 5 years old or 3 years old, you know, your little brother falls down the stairs. Mommy, mommy, you know, but it was just an accident. Oh, no, 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 she pushed me. You know, even a, or as Holmes, I think, famously said, even a dog knows the difference between being stumbled over and being kicked. You know, we make these assessments all the time. There's a difference. But why don't we want to use it here? You said, which I kind of rolled over, but is true, that it's hard to figure that out. It's a lot easier for us 12 people to say, what do we think a reasonable person would have done when a wasp flies in the car, than it is for us to say, do we think this guy is sincere in telling us he was doing the best he could, or do we think he's just a very clever, you know, I've been taken in before by fast-talking people that sounded good and later I found out they were just blowing smoke. So making the assessment is difficult. Would we be a better society if we made legal liability depend upon whether people were trying the best they could? Would we be a worse society if we got into that? Remember that the law has a connection with a larger moral universe. And typically in the language of morality, you know, it's the parable of the talents in I think it's Matthew's gospel. You know, the servants get different amounts of money and some go off and make lots of earn lots of interest and some bury it in the ground, and the one who buries it in the ground is not a happy ending to that story. It's to whom much has been given, much will be required. So in the moral universe, there's a very it's more like a subjective evaluation. But the question is that a function you want your government performing? Even if it's a government composed of 12 jurors, you want 12 jurors given the power to decide whether you're doing as well as they think you should be doing? Or do you want the government to have a more limited role of simply saying, here's the bar, if you meet this test, here's your reward, if you don't meet this test, here's your punishment? So, you know, in most activities in life, we get judged on our performance. If you go to the dry cleaner, you're not really interested in having them tell you how they did the best they could with your thing, the clothes you're planning to wear for your friend's wedding. You want to know whether it's done and whether it, you know, is clean and didn't get burned or whatever. If you hire somebody to remodel your bathroom, or if you, you know, you're judging people all the time by their performance. So when the law goes about deciding who has to pay for this fire damage, the law is primarily interested in performance. Occasionally we'll make some accommodations, as we'll see later on, but most of the time the criterion we use is how well did you do relative to an objective standard? And while we sort of feel bad for the defendant that he is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, and that may be through no fault of his. And if some of you have, you know, wonderful IQs and are really, really smart, that may be through no merit of yours. You're lucky. But still, as we work our way through the world, and as the law begins to set up the rules by which people are rewarded and people are punished, the rules tend to be, the more common feature is, an objective measure. Did you meet this standard or not? And maybe in a different moral universe with a supernatural as opposed to a natural judge, there will be an evaluation of what you did with what you had, But again, there may be some reluctance to put that power in the hands of even of 12 jurors whom you otherwise get along with. But I'm not sure that's the function I want them to be playing. Ms. Rossi. Oh, okay. The rule was dismissed. I think that's what it says at the end of the case. Right. So sort of like, yeah, the rule is discharged. So you get so-and-so speaking in support of the rule, just as we had that summary, remember, in the turntable case, so-and-so, Strickland or somebody, for the plaintiff in error. So you have somebody essentially making the case for the appellant in support of the rule, but then at the end they say the rule will be discharged. That is, the stay will be lifted, in effect, the judgment will be imposed. So after the trial, the defendant says, again, asks for this rule nisi, a sort of stay of execution. Let's review this before we carry it out. And they get to the end and say, no, there's no error here. There's no reason to delay the imposition of the judgment. The defendant will now be forced to pay for the damage. Okay. So, again, moving along here and figuring out, okay, what is negligence? As this case establishes, negligence is the failure to use reasonable care as judged not by the subjective good faith of the defendant or lack thereof, but whether the defendant met a standard of reasonable care. Adams versus Bullock. The question... a little more about how exactly we would characterize reasonable care. Mr. King, why don't you tell us about Adams? Somebody drew this here. I think I did in the earlier section there. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Here's the wire going. We're sort of taking the looking down the bridge. He's walking down the bridge. He's swinging this wire. It's flexible enough that it can sort of wrap around the parapet of the bridge and hit this wire. And instantaneously the electrical circuit is formed there, and all the juice that's supposed to go down to the trolley as it's going along, all that juice flows through the wire and burns it badly. Okay? Well, impossible to insulate it and do this thing that if you've been to Seattle or San Francisco where they have these buses like this with a conductor, as they call it, that goes from the top of the bus up to this wire as it's going along its route. If you're going to continuously move across this thing, you have to have a place where the electricity can be transmitted, and you couldn't do it that way, but of course you don't have to. This isn't the only way to run a trolley. You could run a trolley with different kinds of propulsion, or you also could, I suppose, run something out, you know, buy up all the rights to the land around where the electric conductor is. It's not impossible to prevent injuries like this, and certainly you could spend more money to reduce the likelihood of preventing this kind of injury. Okay, so what happens in the trial of the case? Okay, so the jury returns a verdict for the plaintiff. Defendant appeals. There's actually a next step before we get here. We're in New York, where they have this funny way, at least to us, of describing their court system. At the trial court level, they call it the Supreme Court. The next stop is the appellate division, and at the top of the food chain is the Court of Appeals. So the Court of Appeals decides whether to reverse the Supreme Court. If you're thinking federal court terminology, that's just upside down. But that's what they call it in New York. Okay, so we're now up at the Court of Appeals. What did the appellate division do? No, actually, that's the middle intermediate court affirmed the trial court's finding for the plaintiff, and now the defendant is up at the last stop here at the Court of Appeals arguing to overturn the jury's verdict. What does Cardozo say? Okay, so the jury found that in this case the defendant didn't adopt all reasonable procedures. So why doesn't that stand? What's Cardozo doing messing with the jury's verdict here? Well, isn't that the definition of negligence, that you didn't do something that would have made it safer? Or am I missing something? Why is that not an accurate description of it? Why? Why do we say that even though they could have made it safer, what they did was reasonable? Remember, unlike the WASP case where the jury came in on the side of the defendant, okay, one issue is how unusual or unexpected this was. And certainly this particular accident, you couldn't have predicted that at this spot, by this mechanism, somebody would get hurt. However, accidents like this, I suspect, would be a fairly regular occurrence. You know, every month, every other month, twice a year, once every 2 years. If you operate a trolley system, periodically, people are going to come in contact with these overhead wires and get hurt. Why aren't they liable for those injuries? Is Tomichi, how do you say your name? Tomich, okay. Okay. To the extent that the plaintiff's complaint is, you used a dangerous system. Why didn't you have horses pulling your trolleys? That would have eliminated this risk. Part of the problem in this case is Cardozo doesn't tell us what the plaintiff's argument was. We're sort of left without really, from reading Cardozo's opinion, you'd think the plaintiff basically said, I got injured, it didn't have to happen, I deserve a recovery. We don't know what the plaintiff argued, really, by way of comparison. You were negligent because you didn't do this. And essentially what Cardozo was saying, not as clearly as he might have, is it's not enough to simply show you were injured, and it's not even enough to show that the accident could have been prevented. What the plaintiff has to show is that a reasonable person would have prevented it. And reasonable people won't take precautions that, in effect, cost too much, come at too high a price. Now, later on, when we get to the Carroll Towing case, we get much more explicit about a quantified version of this comparison, of making it into an equation and talking about numbers. But right here, Cardozo is giving you at least the concept that negligence or the standard of reasonable care is a balancing process. It's never enough to show that the accident could have been prevented. You've got to show that it came at an acceptable price, that this is something that was that was acceptable in terms of its impact on the rest of life, such that a reasonable person would have done it. And again, Cardozo may be stingy with the facts, and plaintiff may have put on a better case than what Cardozo tells us about, but we don't see in the cards here a showing that there was something that the defendant didn't do that a reasonably prudent person would have done, or they did that a reasonably prudent person wouldn't have done. Anyway, we'll have to pick up with that again tomorrow. Last calls for books. I really want to get rid of these things if I possibly can. So if you're all right, I'll take what I have here.